Good morning, everyone. Good to see you. There's so much to talk about today, so I'll try to be brief and give us an opportunity for some discussion. Our parsha brings up some very interesting things. It's called Shmini, the eighth. And this is sort of the culmination of all the instructions and the doings of the building of the Mishkan. The Mishkan, the dwelling place, which is what it means, the indwelling place of the divine, and it's within us. So we also get the word Shekhinah from this as well, which dwells within, our indwelling soul, if you will. It's the eighth day. It's the eighth day of consecration. Eight is an important number in our tradition. You're familiar with the eight. It's mostly most well-known because of the association of the eighth day with the Brit Milah, with circumcision. And the eighth is always seen, also you know there's 8 days of Hanukkah, by the way, as well. All of our festivals are mostly either 7 day or 1 day. And eight means supernatural, something beyond the natural. A male baby comes into the world with a foreskin, and we basically intervene, and we reveal something. They're different. I won't get involved in the graphic display of that, but you're basically unfolding, revealing, and participating in this act of creation, which is not a natural thing, which is beyond the natural. So Hanukkah, it's the story of the oil, etc., etc. It's beyond the natural, beyond seven. Seven for us is natural. The world created in 6 days, and the resting on the Sabbath. So seven for us is a very common number, eight a little less so. So it's the eighth day. It's the opening day of the public service in the Mishkan, okay? And everybody's gathered, of course, and they want to see if this system that's been created, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, this system that's been created, whether or not it's going to create what is called in theological language right association with the divine. Will it connect into the cosmic plan, right? It's like when you plug in your computer and you open it up, will the operating system be there in order to go on and do the next step? So I have noise. If you hear noise in the background, it's just the children. What can you do? You can't shut them up. You have to let them talk. So the eighth day, it's opening day. Excuse me. Just one moment.
Perhaps we can just pause the recording and then start it again now. Oh, yeah, I think you can pause it. He's back.
Excuse me. So it's the opening day. And if you can imagine, think about opening day of Fenway, which is coming up soon, okay? And it's everybody's there, and they're waiting for the first pitch. And indeed, the first offering is put onto the Mizbeach, the altar. And yes, the fire of God comes from above and consumes it. Okay, the system works. All the connections are there. And indeed, that's what was the hope. And it's the first one, in a sense, that God takes that way. The only one, by the way. And it sort of lets the system kick in. Now, this idea of which we'll deal with in a second, the idea of having an operating system that is not whimsical is very important. It's not whimsy. This order has to exist in the way that it exists. And the Mishkan is basically, later on in the temple as well, the Mishkan is totally the same all the time, which it makes life easier because it means everyone who comes to the Mishkan, everyone who comes to the temple, is going to be treated in the same way within the same operating system. And it doesn't change. There's no, as I often say, there's not going to be a Tat Shabbat next week at the Mishkan, right? That's not going to happen. You want to do Tat Shabbat elsewhere, Gezun to hate, but it's not going to happen in the Mishkan. So it's opening day, the fire comes down, and then there's this strange event that happens, which we'll come back to talk in a minute. Strange event, the two sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, bring their own fire pans, their own incense, if you will, and they bring it towards the Mizbeach, the altar, and they are stricken dead. So imagine the pitcher and the catcher both drop dead at Fenway in the first day. That would be kind of at least an moment, if not something worse. So that's what happens. And Moses' reaction is astonishment, of course, but he tells his brother Aaron, whose two sons have just died, be quiet. And Aaron is silent. We'll talk about that in a moment. Parsha then goes on. The bodies are removed by cousins of them, etc. Then the Parsha goes on and talks a little bit more about why possibly this happened, and it comes up with a rather specious excuse, very specious excuse, is that they were intoxicated by wine. I would put forward to you, as many of the later interpreters say, yes, they were intoxicated by the divine. That's how they were intoxicated. Later, the Parsha goes on to the Kashrut, a very important list of everything that is permitted and everything not permitted. And if you permit me, I'll give you my idiosyncratic idea about why there's Kashrut. Of course, it's considered a chok. A chok means something that you would not arrive at by your own reason. So that has prompted thousands of reasons. The minute you say there's no reason, everybody tries to come up with one. So mine is basically this. If you look at what's permitted and not permitted, you're not permitted to have predators, and you're not permitted to have scavengers. And you have to limit in a very small circle those things that will provide you with meat. And that meat has to be, the blood has to go into the earth. It has to be sort of tofuized, if you will, right? To make it kosher, and it's domesticated animals, and it gives signs of cloven hooves and chewing cud. The theory is that you're not supposed to upset the cycle of nature, which always has predators, it always has scavengers. You have to keep it balanced and not upset that cycle. And at the final verse of those kashrus list is this very bizarre thing: to not boil a kid in the, and it says chelev imo, the milk of its mother. And I am of the totally minority position that that's a mistranslation. And it's really bechelev imo, in the fat of its mother. We know the word chelev, and they read it chalav, you see, but it's really not chalav milk. It's chelev, but I've been searching for years for someone to corroborate my idea, and I have not found it yet. But that would make much more sense to me, the fat of its mother rather than the milk of its mother, which is what you would do when you would use fat or as a sort of a way to cook something, shortening, if you will, if you want to use that term. But like back to the beginning, I was reading a wonderful piece about Hasidic responses to Nadav and Avihu, and the author brings in this beautiful idea from Jacques Cousteau. You don't expect to hear much about Jacques Cousteau, but Jacques Cousteau, and I'll see if I can get it up online. It's a very beautiful description. Let's see if I can get it. Yes. Here it is. This is from a wonderful young scholar, Ariel Mazes, out in California. So he says, undersea divers know of a dangerous and mysterious phenomenon felicitously described by Jacques-Yves Cousteau as the rapture of the deep. I won't do the French, les ivresses de grandes profondeurs. But this state, also called nitrogen narcosis, often manifests as a sensation of overwhelming euphoria akin to intoxication. And faced with intense pressure, likely compounded by chemical imbalance from breathing ordinary air so far beneath the ocean surface, and the mind and the body begin to flex curiously. In this rapture, the diver's judgment and vision become hazardously impaired. Now, he goes on and says, and I found this is very, very, I think, appropriate for what we're talking about today. This subaquatic bliss is all the more dangerous because it may lead to an inscrutable longing to go deeper, overruling the panicked instinct to surface. Cousteau noticed noted after a 1951 dive that I could see stretching temptingly before me as far as my eyes could reach what seemed the infinite sweetness and quiet of a blackness that will yield up the secrets of the universe if only I were to go a bit deeper. And that, on that occasion, Cousteau's instinct for self-preservation prevailed, but he later acknowledged that this brush with limits of reason and mortality transformed him forever. And the combination of physical pressure, the feeling of rapture, and the sweeping undersea expanse have tempted other divers into continuing their journey, even as prudence calls them to return. So I found that to be a very fascinating way of describing what possibly we are discussing when we're talking about Nadav and Avihu, that they sort of have entered into this state. So there's a great debate. Were Nadav and Avihu punished for their sins, whatever they were? And they manufactured the sin, as I say, that they were intoxicated with wine. And thus we learn from that time on, priests should not be intoxicated before they do the service. And that's true even today. I try to remain very rarely intoxicated when I was leading a service, but occasionally it helped, whatever. So that's the one. It's punishment for some sort of sin. And the sin, they expand upon it. They had chutzpah. They thought they had something to add to the situation, and they had the crime of, and this is very important for us, that the crime of spontaneity within a fixed order, right? I told you earlier the temple worked because it was the same all the time. It didn't vary from one day to the other, and they brought in this spontaneity. And Rabbi Sacks and others have commented about what is this tension between spontaneity and order, right? And we have that all through our tradition. In, for instance, tefillot, in our offerings of tefillah, which are in place of the, according to some rabbis, in place of the offerings at the temple, we have keva, the established rules, quote-unquote, of the rabbis who put together the prayers, or the prayer book, however you want to call it. There was no prayer book. And the other one called kavana, which is intentionality that comes from within. So you have both. You have to have that, you have that. So that's a bad balance, that spontaneity has to be anchored and grounded. And when it's not, it can become dangerous, like the subaquatic rapture that will grab them and what could lead, without proper, if you will, precautions, lead to extirpation, to death. All right, so that's one way. Others, as I say, do not see this in a negative light, and this is particularly true in the Kabbalistic and the Hasidic teachings. I won't go into all of them. There are many, many, many ones. But many of them basically have, the rabbis making these statements are associated with their own personal journey of wanting to become close to God, wanting to get close. And of course, the getting close is dangerous, right? We know from the Bible, you have to get close. Hopefully you will lose yourself. And in our tradition, at best, what you can do, according to the Kabbalistic tradition and the Hasidic tradition, the best you can do is cleave onto God, dveikut. Cleave onto God. You don't disappear within it. You don't lose your personality. And also there's this backward and forward. Sometimes you're closer, sometimes you're further away. And you need to retreat before you advance. You need to advance and retreat towards this cleaving onto God. Now, cleaving is an interesting term. Anybody ever see a basketball player hold a basketball in one hand and make it move? Well, from the outside, it looks like the hand and the basketball are together, are one. But in reality, it's still a hand and it's still a basketball, and they are not one thing, but they are basically cleaving one to the other. So, you know, it's a very dramatic story. What is fascinating about the story is later on, in the portion we read on Yom Kippur, of Aaron overcoming his grief, his silence takes on his job, and that is to rededicate the Mishkan again, to cleanse it again after this travesty, if you will, after this horrible event. And there it says, after the death of the two sons, who came close to God. So with no mention of any kind of sin or transgression when it's related later on. So that's, if you're a Bible critic, you say, oh, because this was written by one and this was by the other. I'm not so sure. But the bottom line is that there is a certain exoneration of them in one place, and the other place there's a certain kind of blame put on. So as I say, this is a deep, deep subject. What does it mean to offer yourself up? What does it mean to become close? What does it mean to wanting the term in fancy term is self-abnegation? What does it mean to lose your ego, yourself, and become one with the divine, with that undescribable, by the way, realm that we just can't define? And of course, people wanted to experience it because it's not anything you can achieve in any reasonable way. It's totally not reasonable. And that's what the power is, that it's not reasonable, that it brings in a place of ourselves that is much deeper and wants us to emerge into this mystical union. So we don't have mystical union in our tradition. We have, as I say, dveikut, at most cleaving. So, you know, I'm of, like most Jews, I have a lot of opinions within myself that are not necessarily aligned with each other. You know, I think Philip Roth once said, within each Jew, there is a mob of Jews. You know, and the fact that they don't agree with anything is what makes it rich. You know, if it all already agreed, it would be boring, right? We have this multitude of things within us, sometimes contradictory, but we have them. They're there. What was going on in the mind of Nadav and Avihu? So they say, besides trying to find fault with them, which of course many of the rabbis do, we find, if you will, this deep, deep desire to become one with, to go into the, I'm trying to use a good word, because abyss is sort of a negative word, right? But to go into the, if you will, the depths of the divine, to make it as if we are no longer separate. And thus they die. It's imponderable. It's not something that makes any sense. And the story is oblique enough to give us the opportunity to say many different things. But I think this challenge of how one lives within order, and we just had a Seder and order, the ultimate Apollonian holiday, you know, Passover, you know, and it sort of tries to balance the Dionysian celebration of Purim, right, the Bacchanal, right, and then we have to, you know, make sure that doesn't get out of hand. So our Christian brothers and sisters created Lent, right, which before you get to Easter, and then we also created all kinds of ways to restrict ourselves. I often kid, but I think it's true. Getting ready for Pesach takes a month, and and in that month, Jewish women reenact slavery, and they only say they are free after the second Seder, free, free at last, and they begin to breathe again. I say Jewish women because, what can I say? They uphold our tradition in a way that a lot of Jewish men don't. So I always appreciate that. Also, growing up with a wife and three daughters, I can't say anything else. So I'm going to open it up a little bit because I've taken too much time. But I just think this, you know, how do we manage this idea of spontaneity? And is spontaneity really a dangerous thing? Can spontaneity create disorder? And is that something we need in our lives? Do we need that? So I'll just give you my opinion. I hope to hear yours. And basically, I would say you certainly need both. You need the capacity to stand on a grounding that is solid, and then have the capacity to use that solid, if you will, ground to leap up, knowing you will return, right? Sometimes I use the term, the rabbinic drashah, you know, the things that we talk about with sermons, is because we are on a springboard, like a diving board, and we jump up, create some sort of interpretation based on the text, right? It has nothing to do with the text often, but based on the text. And you hope, like everyone who dives, that when you leap off of it, you don't hit the side of the pool. That doesn't work very, very well. You hope you get in to the middle and you splash, knowing that, oh, phew, I didn't hit the side of the pool. And every rabbi, when he finishes his sermon, waits that 30 seconds or a minute and see what the reaction is. And if nobody yells out, that's good, because the role of a sermon is to unite people, not to divide them. Okay, Bobby.